call the meeting to order, and Representative Broad is going to move the minutes. Any discussion of the minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? We've approved the minutes. We've got two bills and then a presentation from the Human Services Department, so why don't we start on the first bill, House File 120. Representative Mariani, I saw him a minute ago. There he is. And I will move House File 120 to be recommended to pass.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Good morning. I'm Representative Carlos Mariani, and Mr. Chair, I'm wondering, on page 3, there was a drafting error, and I'm wondering if you would be so kind to move an amendment to get this bill in the shape I would like it to be. This would be on line 312, 3.12. The number, the $700 number should read $740.
Okay, I'll move an amendment on line 312, strike the 700 and insert 740. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The amendment is adopted, and Representative Mariani, your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My bill has to do with a program that serves chemically dependent men. It's a terrific program that's been in existence in the Twin Cities, doing this work for over 33 years. They have a good success rate. It's a good program. It's an effective program. 48% of their clients successfully graduate from their program. 60% of their clients are working when they graduate from the program. What they're asking for is an increase of service rates from 542 monthly to 737 monthly for their Ramsey County facility, which is located just inside my district, not too far from here, from the Capitol on Summit Avenue. I've got individuals here that can speak in much more detail, but again, the action that we're asking for is to increase their bed capacity to 32 beds in Hennepin County facility, and to, as I mentioned earlier, to increase the service rate for the Summit Avenue facility. Currently, this facility is experiencing losses of about 50,000. Is that 50,000 per year? And that's been happening for quite a few years, for the last 10 years. And it's obviously a big burden for them. It makes it difficult for them to do the capital improvements that they should be doing to keep the facility to keep their facility in good condition, and also obviously makes it difficult for them to provide the kind of employment benefits that they should be able to provide in this market. So, Mr. Chair and members, I'm going to ask Mr. Bill Aragone to tell you more about the facility and more specifics around the request.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Would you state your name for the...
My name is Bill Aragone, and I'm the CEO of BK Aragone, Inc. This is a family business that was started 33 years ago, and I'm here to tell you about the history as to why we need this legislation. Back in 1997, our rates were, we lobbied for rates as a group with the Association of Supportive Living Residences, and the rates were increased, and our 255 Summit facility was not given the rate that was okay, that was passed by the legislature. The Human Services Department of Ramsey County held back some of that rate with the promise that if we needed increases in the future, they would pass those along. only to find out in years to come that they did not have the right or the ability to pass those along. Then in 2001, we asked Senator Pappas to author a bill to bring our facility up to the playing field, so to speak, and she did author that for us, and it passed several committees. However, the ASLR, the Association of Supporting Living Residences, had also obtained another increase that looked it was likely that it would pass. A staffer from one of the senator's offices reasoned that we didn't need the increase for the V. Caragone facility, and so they pulled that bill. What happened when the increase was implemented for the ASLR, it was converted into a percentage, thereby leaving our facility behind the playing field again. So we're here just to ask to be brought up with the rest of the playing field for everyone else who does the same services that we do. This is the rate that is prescribed by the legislature for the quality of service that we give. We have 24-hour supervision, med lockup, med supervision, three meals a day, on-site advocacy, and goal setting for the clients, as well as outsourcing for any of their needs that we cannot provide for them. We also have on-site nursing available to them as well. With regards to the second part of our place in the bill, we have a facility in Hennepin County which was approved to move up to 32 beds back in 1996 by the head of the Department of Human Services of Hennepin County. And so we've been operating at 32 beds for about roughly 10 years. And the new head of DHS could not find anything to substantiate that in our contract and in history. So she insisted that we immediately vacate those beds and that we needed to seek the approval of the legislature to increase our beds back to 32 beds. It's a pretty big burden to go down to 30 beds. It will cost us about $35,000 a year, and we have very tight margins in our business, and it's really a burden that we really can't handle. So we're asking that you would increase our beds. We're already zoned for that. We've been operating that way for 10 years already. So that's really the extent of the story behind what we're asking you to do.
If I could ask a question, Mr. Aragone, could you clarify for me, in your St. Paul facility, sounds like you're regulated by the city rather than by the state. You said the Human Services Commissioner of the city had an influence there, and you just talked about somebody in Human Services in Hennepin County. Was that Hennepin County or was that the State Department of Human Services?
Mr. Chair, Hennepin County, we were dealing with the Hennepin County Human Services that I can remember the man's name, Gary Biskins from Hennepin County back in 1996, approved that we go from 30 to 32 beds. With regards to the Ramsey County, neither of these are zoning issues which involve the city. Again, the Ramsey County is a rate issue that not passed along by the Department of Human Services in Ramsey County back in 1997. Does that answer your question? I'm not sure.
Well, I'm being educated here because I would have thought that the State Department of Human Services would send you the money directly and not run it through a county. But did you want to say something, Representative Marianne?
Not on that.
Mr. Chair, many members, the county is the one that negotiates contracts and signs contracts with facilities like ours.
Okay.
However, it's the legislature that actually dictates the price of the beds. And if I knew then what I know today, I would have called the senator up and said, they're not giving us the rate that was approved, and I think I wouldn't be in this position.
Representative Abler.
Well, now I'm more confused. I was just, about the rates and negotiated rates. Mr. Chair, do you know, or who could tell us, if it is the pass-through rate, how does the county get to negotiate something else? Do they get a percentage or something for donuts, or do they, is there truly a contractual, since we're a county-based state, does the county get to negotiate up to a number? Do you know that, or does somebody know that?
Does one of our staff people know, or...
Mr. Chairman, Representative Abler, my name is Dwayne Elg. I'm at the Department of Human Services. What you're looking at is a program that's licensed by the Department of Health. It's a program that is paid for by the Department of Human Services. It's called the Group Residential Housing Program. It pays room and board, and in this case, a supplementary service rate. The rate cap is established by the legislature. Counties are authorized to negotiate up to that cap, depending on the needs of the clients that are being served.
Mr. Chair?
Well, Representative Abler.
So, do the counties get the full rate and then they can apply the money to other programs if they want, or do they get only the amount that they award to the contractee?
Actually, the county doesn't get the money. The money is paid directly to the vendor. So there is no opportunity to take an administrative fee or any other fees from the rate.
Mr. Chair, so if the county would negotiate a lower rate, does the surplus, does that extra margin stay in the general fund?
That's correct.
Mr. Chair, why would a county care if they saved any money then? Is that something you could, I just don't understand the incentive of the county to offer less than the maximum rate then.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Abler, counties are... I guess very good fiduciary agents for us. They have a tendency to assign a value to the services that are being provided that is based on the needs of the clients. And if they feel that the full rate is not necessary, they will negotiate a lower rate.
Thank you very much.
You know, other questions for the witness? Representative Loeffler.
Mr. Chairman, and to Representative Abler's point, I mean, I think that you know, groups of clients, particularly in a large county, really vary in their needs. And some may not speak English, and some may have different comorbidities or, challenging issues. And I would assume that that's part of why you would want a range of rates, because not all individuals or groups of individuals are the same. I assume that, I don't know, I've never been involved in that process, but it makes sense. Just like we have case mix for seniors, we should have, you know, some differentiation amongst other groups.
Representative Marianne.
Mr. Chair, I do have a resident here that would like to offer a brief testimony if that would be helpful.
Representative Gottwald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do notice that this bill calls for the exemption from the moratorium, and I know this is going to come up in some other bills that this committee will be reviewing. Has there been any consideration given to, I know some counties have extra beds, if you will, or extra margin on numbers of beds, whereas other counties, such as yours, are asking for additional beds. Has there been any thought to doing either some sort of swapping or pooling or sharing of the excess number of beds from other counties?
Representative Mariani, do you have any? I mean, obviously, it's not been brought up to this committee, so we have not discuss that.
Mr. Chair, I'm not aware of that, but I think someone here has some thoughts.
Mr. Chairman, Dwayne L., Department of Human Services. There are what are known as banked beds. There is a moratorium on the expansion of the number of beds that receive the Group Residential Housing Supplementary Service Rate. And counties that have vendors that go out of business or decide to change their book of business so as not to need the supplementary rate counties have the option of holding on to those beds for future development, or they can close them permanently and cash them out through a different process. That's in the GRH statute. There are currently probably about 160 bank beds throughout the state, and they're in probably 11 or 12 counties. Counties do have the option of requesting these beds from one another, and all it takes is county board action to release the beds and county board action to receive the beds. And then they could be developed by the receiving county. They are guarded as a resource right now, and counties are somewhat reluctant to hand them off to other counties.
Thank you, Mr. Elm. New testifier, would you state your name for the tape? And then
yes, my name is Matthew Ringstead, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Matthew Ringstead, I'm 47 years old, single, never been married. I currently reside at the Arizona House on Summit Avenue. I have been a functioning alcoholic for many years. Since 2001, my disease has become progressively worse. I switched from mainly a beer drinker to all vodka. My choice to use alcohol over anything else that was important in life has cost me dearly. I've lost jobs, destroyed my credit, and made it nearly impossible to rent an apartment. My physical and mental health have deteriorated. I have dug a pit that is going to take quite some time to get out of. By June of 2005, I could not function without the use of alcohol. I've had many blackouts, I was unemployed, could not pay my bills, and was drinking 5 to 6 1.75 liters of vodka a week. My family did not know how bad I was getting because I would not speak to them unless I was apparent enough to lie to them about how I was doing. I was very fortunate to have a friend in the AA program to guide me to seek help. I received a Rule 25 assessment and went to inpatient treatment at St. Joe's and followed up with outpatient treatment. I was also granted the opportunity to stay at the Arizona House. This saved my life. The staff and program at Arizona gave me hope that someday I could dig myself out of the pit that I had dug for myself. Arizona has guidelines and rules that enable a person to relearn the basics needed to function as a responsible and accountable person in society. I used these lessons along with the support of AA and my sponsor to stay sober for 14 months. Then I quit doing the things that I needed to, through no fault of anyone else but myself. Eventually, I started with the old behaviors, no meetings, not keeping in touch with the sober community. In March of 2006, I went back to work as a line cook in a restaurant, which has always been a very stressful situation for me. In September of 2006, I started drinking again. This lasted for approximately 2 weeks, which in those 2 weeks, I had been at the same amount of use that I was back in 2005. I realized that I needed to get back into treatment because once again I had lost my job and wasted all of my money. I put myself into detox and received another Rule 25 and went back to treatment at St. John's. When I got back to treatment, I requested that they keep me the whole 10 days instead of the 4 days that I stayed the last time. While in treatment, I called Arizona and asked if they had any beds available because I really needed some place to stay. My last day at Arizona, I learned a lot from the staff and welcomed their advice and compassion for us alcoholics and addicts. I needed their guidance, caring, and stability to once again set me on the correct path to recovery. While at Arizona, I've met many people who have been a great deal of help to me in my sobriety in the past and will help in the future. I am planning to go back to school in June to change my profession, and I'm still seeking employment as of today and housing as well. And as of today, I have 135 days of sobriety.
Thank you, Mr. Ringstead. Any questions? Representative Abler.
Just one final one, and thank you for coming, by the way. To a different question. Is Ramsey County going to come and tell us, no, don't give them the money, or... I realize, and sometimes you have to do legislative action, but it seems like it's reasonable. But I'm just curious if they'll come and...
Well, we'll open it up to anybody who wants to testify. Just state your name for the...
My name is Joe Cuoco, Mr. Chairman, members of the House. I am the Senior Director at VK Arizona. I will be really brief here. I just wanted to touch on some things that Matt had said, maybe to inform some people that don't know a lot about people in recovery. It is quite normal for members in recovery to relapse. It's actually part of their process in the road to recovery. Just as when anyone is building a foundation, you have to make sure the foundation is strong. When they relapse, they find areas that they actually have to work on, and we deal with that at the house. And just like in life, whenever, not that this house committee would ever find a mistake that they made, but when other people find mistakes that they made, then they work on those areas as well. And I believe the statistics are that 20% of the people in Minnesota that should be in recovery are in recovery. The 80% that are not actually cost the state of Minnesota more money, whether it's through health care or crime or whatever the reasons. So I know beyond the shadow of doubt there's dozens upon dozens upon dozens that have gone through these types of programs. Relapse is part of it. They learn the new area in their life where they actually have to work on, and by that process they obtain the long-term sobriety that they need. And so, again, I thank you for this time, Mr. Chairman, and members of the House.
Representative Mariani.
Mr. Chair, I believe Mr. Arrigoni has an answer for Representative Abler's question.
Mr. Arrigoni.
Mr. Chair, Representatives, the question about whether the county would not want to pass on those an increase, I think the answer would be that they would like to. I know it's a confusing issue because the question was brought up about negotiations, but they no longer at the county level, as I understand, have the ability to negotiate. There were some changes that have happened over the last many years, and they negotiated with us in 1996. However, they no longer have the ability to negotiate, although local DHS people agree they'd like to give us that rate. They say they're stuck in that rate. We won an RFP for some other beds that we found out had a much lower rate as well, and so we turned down the contract unless they could raise the rate. They said that they do not have the ability to raise the rates on their own, that those beds, although they were vacated, some beds I'm speaking of on an RFP were vacated some 4 years ago. They can only engage in a contract at the rate they were at 4 years ago.
Representative Marion.
Mr. Chair, I'm hoping that, I'm sorry, I should have paid more closer attention. I'm hoping that the motion before us is to have this bill laid over for possible inclusion.
That's my intent.
Which would certainly give us more time to sort out some of the confusion around this issue. It's clear, at least in my mind, that these good folks are kind of stuck in a kind of a weird place, if you will. And in the meantime, they're taking some very serious losses while they continue to provide some very valuable services to chemically dependent men in the area. And so I certainly hope that we can sort out what the weird part of that is and be able to provide them some relief.
Well, Representative Mariani, it's as long as I've been on this committee, there's still things I need to learn. And this is the relationship between these kinds of housing and their counties wasn't clear to me. So it's not your problem, it's my problem. Before we, Representative Gottwald.
Just one more question on the bill, if I could, Mr. Chair. Under Section 2, it's the very last page of the bill, page 3, and this is perhaps for my education as well as anything else. I notice it says, shall negotiate a supplementary rate in addition to the rate specified. And the two quid pro quos, number one, is located in Ramsey County and has had a group residential housing contract with the county since 1982 and has been licensed since 1979. It seems to me that language is obviously written to be very specific about one provider. And is that an intent we want to support? Is do we want to leave this more open-ended?
Representative Gottwald, we often have a series of these kinds of individual specific for a particular facility, and we like to think that all the facilities are the same, but they're all different. They all have their own individual needs, and so this bill will address the needs of one particular facility. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Chairman Huntley. I guess I could ask you this, Mr. Aragone. Listening to Mr. Ringstead, it sounded like the first time he went into treatment, he was there for a short time. The second time, it sounded like the time was doubled. I believe he said 10 days. So how long does a resident stay at your facility? And have you noticed a difference between the number of days they're in treatment, if it's shorter or longer, and which is more beneficial, and what your recidivism rate is?
Mr. Aragone.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I've been around the business for over 30 years. My mother started the business in our home, and she was an alcoholic. Things have changed a lot. It used to be 30 years ago that the minimum stay was 2 weeks in treatment and upwards of 30 days. Our business was started because it was evident in the treatment continuum that there was a need for aftercare. We provide the aftercare piece, and what Matthew referred to was, I think on his first treatment, they kept him to 4 days, which didn't seem to be enough. It's just a short time for such a long period in people's lives. We're dealing with chronic alcoholics and drug addicts. Generally, on average, they've been abusing for over 10 years. So if to change 10 years of behavior around in 4 to 10 days is not realistic. The recidivism is high, and so the state and county uses our facilities to help to cut that recidivism down. In Ramsey County, there's a limit of 90 days to their stay in our aftercare facility. And they do sometimes grant a 30-day extension. And we do quite well in that facility. However, in Hennepin County, they've done some of their own studies that they've funded. And Hennepin County believes in an open-ended stay, and they feel that their figures and statistics have supported that there would be less recidivism with the longer stay. So it's not unlikely in our Hennepin County facility to have the gentleman in for 6 months, and there are some even up to a year. But then they tend to be more successful.
Is there anybody in the audience wishes to testify on this? I don't see any, so I will move that this bill be laid on the table for possible inclusion in the omnibus finance bill. And Mr. Walls, you had a...
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to add, due to the author's amendment, we'll be asking for a revision to the fiscal note, but back of the napkin shows it should go from about $71,000 a year to $84,000 a year.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Erickson.
Just a clarification, Mr. Chair. We're going to lay it over, right? We're not laying it on the table. We're laying it over for possible action later.
Lay it over.
Thank you.
Representative Marianne.
Mr. Chair, members, I thank you for your close attention. I also learned a lot just in the past few minutes, and we certainly will work on this issue of, you know, what's happening with Ramsey County. I do want to remind members that the Hennepin County facility is receiving the higher rate.
Yes.
And it's the same, you know, it's the same, obviously it's the same program, the same group of people are running this rate. But we'll try to get some more information for your consideration at whatever point you then are ready to move it off the table for consideration. Thank you.
All those in favor of laying this over for possible inclusion signify by saying, or we don't need that, do we?
No.
No. It's done.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah. Representative Ward. Start out, I will move House File 185. And Representative Ward, I think you have an amendment, 007?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
007?
007, yes, Mr. Chair.
I'll move the amendment to the bill. That's 007. Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Okay, the amendment is adopted, and now, Mr. Ward, do you want to discuss your bill as amended?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is John Ward, Representative Ward from District 12A in the Brainerd Lakes area. I'm here today to talk about House File 185, which is a request for group residential subsidy through a program that we call Teen Challenge. You may know in the Brainerd area we had a region treatment center that shut down, and so as part of the reuse plan in the region treatment center, we have been looking at agencies and programs that will come into that past region treatment center that will abide by health and helping kind of agencies. Teen Challenge definitely is that kind of a program. Teen Challenge is a program that is for chemically, alcohol, meth addicts, very highly successful, success rate, fiscally responsible. We need the group residential subsidy in order to have them take over operation of one of the buildings within our region treatment center. So you should have a fiscal note in your folders as well, and I'm not going to take any more time because we have some testifiers that are more important for you to hear than me, including Rich Herber, who's the director of that, and I'm going to give Rich a few moments to explain Teen Challenge a bit more to the members. And then we have four testifiers that have from the Brainerd Lakes area that have stories as to why we need this type of facility in the Brainerd Lakes area.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Rich Sherber. I'm the Executive Director of Teen Challenge, and I'm here to speak on behalf of the bill. I'll give you a little bit of background. Many of you know who Teen Challenge is, but for those who don't, there's 182 Teen Challenge centers across America. There's over 300 Teen Challenge centers outside of the U.S. border. This program has been around for 50 years and has been gained a lot of national attention as being one of the more effective residential drug rehabilitation programs in the nation. It's got a lot of bipartisan support. In Minneapolis, we operate one of the largest residential programs. At any given time, we have about 400 residential beds, and of that, part of them are teens. We average about 60 teens in the program, of which we don't get any funding, by the way, whatsoever. These are at-risk youth with long addictive behaviors. And then the only funding we're getting for the one-year program in Minneapolis is the same type of subsidy that you just heard about, group residential housing. It's a board and lodge subsidy. What we're experiencing in Brainerd is that a number of years ago, as you heard already, the legislature put a ceiling cap on any supplemental services. And Hennepin County has defined these supplemental services. I think there's 12 of them, and they're very basic. And so you can open up a board or lodge, and you get the $730, and you just have to have Mr. L could give us more information on it, but it's very basic, just providing meals and a shelter, and very little staffing. The supplemental services that Hennepin County requires a minimum. You've got to have at least a menu on the wall. You have to have 24-hour day supervision. You have to monitor people's meds, and there's really basic. What you need about our program is that we actually run a 60-day license extended care program, and our 60-day license program is we've modeled the one-year program identical to that 60. So basically, our program, for all intents and purposes, is almost identical to the licensed model of the program. The average cost for our residents is about $2,400 a month to put him through this residential program. And the bottom line is that it's working. There's been so many studies that have been done on Teen Challenge, and all of them that I'm aware of have shown over 70% success of these 180 Teen Challenge centers. For us, we have been approached by over 40 community leaders in the Brainerd area. This includes the Sheriff's Department, the County Board, over 50 and some clergy members, local business members, saying our meth and chronic addiction problem is epidemic. We've looked around. We want Teen Challenge to be up there. And this is what we're proposing. If we try to start a Teen Challenge program at the $700 a month, there is no way we can operate this. If we get the subsidy, that'll bring it up to $1,400 a month, and our costs are $2,800 a month to operate the program. There's nothing in it for Teen Challenge. If I had my way, I would tell our good representative board, I'm busy, I'm too busy now. But the bottom line is that you'll hear this afternoon in the testimonies that you're about to hear, there is an epidemic. We're getting at any given time probably 25 to 30 residents coming out of Crow Wing County. Many of them are adjudicated here from the courts, and the courts don't know what to do with these chronic addicts. They use our program because the residents stay there for 12 to 13 months. They're using Teen Challenge because it's very effective, and this is a win in several ways, and I'll end with this. First of all, this is not some inebriate housing facility. This is the residents stay there a year. We get them off the drugs and alcohol. We work them. We have a strong reentry program, and it's working. You're going to hear. Number two is that it is a faith-based model. If you interview the majority of the people coming in our programs, their peer groups before they come in are gang members and drug dealers and people who are violators of the law. We work very close with the faith community. We have a mentoring program. The studies have shown that it does work. I've got the studies I want to share with you today with the National Center of Addiction Studies, National Center of Addiction and Substance Abuse, that faith-based programs by far are the most effective. Lastly, I've got data here. A study showed in 2002 the average cost for 30-day treatment was $11,940. That's almost $12,000 for the average cost of a 30-day treatment. That means in for 30 days, if you add two more weeks on there, we can do in 6 weeks a whole year program, probably more effect, not probably. I'll challenge match apples to apples with any of them. More effectively in 6 weeks, or this with the same money that we can get to run our program. And lastly, it's a win-win. For every dollar that we can get in GRH, we're going to match that by raising private dollars to keep the program operating. So at this time, we're going to ask several of the people who graduates and others who are part of the program. You've got a little handout, and I just want to share this before the first one comes up. Seth Evans has graduated the program. He's in college. You'll see his picture here on the back. See that guy with the long hair? He was the guy that if you visit the meth booth at the state fair, he was the one with the County Attorneys Association that organized this whole meth for volunteers. He spent hundreds of hours down there. He never got paid a penny. I've got his rap sheet right here. It's 15 pages. Here, right on the first page, there's two different cases, a long history He spent 5 years in prison, 15 pages of violations with Crow Wing and Morrison County. At one point, he had hung himself from the county jail, and the jailer came in and cut the cord, and he flopped down. He was so just in despair, and today he's out there helping in the community. He's graduating and wants to go into social service to help others, so he'll just share for just a minute, and then a couple of the others. Thank you.
So, Mr. Chair, we have four testifiers from the Teen Challenge program, and they're going to be brief, but they do have great stories to tell. They're from the Brainerd Lakes area, so please allow that.
Fine. Go ahead and spit your name.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members of the committee. My name is Seth Evans. I am that man that's inside that picture there. I used drugs since I was about 13 years old. 15 years of it was IV use, with the majority of that being methamphetamine. I lived in the Brainerd area for over 12 years, and I hurt myself and everybody around me pretty much. As Pastor Rich said, I have about 5.5 years of incarceration, all because of drugs, and I was allowed to go to Teen Challenge instead of going to prison. I had been to prison before, and when I went there, I went to a treatment facility in there. They just told me that I would be coming back. They gave me, really, it wasn't even addressing any of my problems. It was behavior modification. They promised me that I would be back in prison, and within a year of my release from prison, that's what happened, is I ended up going back to jail. The courts allowed me to go to Teen Challenge instead of going back to prison, and when I got to Teen Challenge, I was taught to recognize, to deal with the problems that I was using for, that I actually had the choice not to go back and use, how to recognize signs early and the tools that I needed not to stop that, to stop whatever it was and address those issues before they became use. I graduated from Teen Challenge over a year and a half ago, and I am in school to help others. I believe that I'm in a position where I can help other people. I do as much as I possibly can to serve the community, and I don't do that out of need. I do that out of gratefulness for the people that have helped me. And I believe that without Teen Challenge, I would be dead right now. While I was in prison, I mean, the only thing that I learned inside the treatment facility and in the prison was how to cook dope, how to make different recipes, and you know, it was my destruction. It wasn't my help. But at Teen Challenge, I found help.
Any questions for Mr. Evans? Representative Broaden.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you so much for being here, Mr. Evans. I'm curious about your statement about behavior modification and the differences between Teen Challenge and what you had before. When you talk about behavior modification, what were they, just quickly, what were they telling you to do or not do inside the prison versus Teen Challenge?
Well,
Mr. Evans,
thank you. It was really, to be honest with you, it was about victims. It was about I remember the biggest thing that I learned there was that in the prison, it's a New Dimensions, it's the treatment program, was something called ripple effect, how my actions would affect several other people, not just myself. There was a lot of just, really, there wasn't anything there that I could honestly use. Not even enough for me to remember. And at the time, I had been sober for over a year. I think I would remember more of it if it helped at all. You know.
Other questions?
Did that answer your question?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Evans.
Hi, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jennifer Yui, and I'm 31 years old. I have been born and raised in Brainerd, Minnesota. And I was an IV drug user of methamphetamines for 13 years. I have been in and out of jails numerous times. I have been to Shakopee Prison. I have been in 6 other treatment centers before this, before I came to Teen Challenge, and I had gone to my probation officer asking for help again, once again, and he had mentioned Teen Challenge. It was a year-long program. I knew I needed a year-long program. Other programs that I had been into, the 30 days, I would hardly even detox off of meth before going back out again. I spent 18 months in Shakopee Prison, and I went through a treatment program in there that I got out and used that day, the day I got out of prison. Coming into Teen Challenge, I had no hope anymore. I thought that this was my life. This is what I had become, was a drug addict. I've tried to commit suicide 3 or 4 other times. And coming into Teen Challenge, they had just showed me a whole new way of living. They've given me hope that I graduated the program in July of 2005, and I also am pursuing college for ministry. Teen Challenge has completely changed my life. I am a whole different person, and my looks and everything have changed.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you, Ms. Huey.
Hi, Mr. Chair, members of the board. My name is David Peroska. I've got about, I've been using drugs and marijuana since I was about 15. I was an IV meth user for the last 6 years. And I've got 5 felonies, been in and out of jail as long as I can remember. And they're all related to drugs in one form or another. I don't know. I'm really nervous. But
take your time.
Yeah, Teen Challenge has just turned my life around completely. Like she was saying, I thought that, I was an addict. This is the way I was always going to be. That gave me an excuse to go use. And they've shown me that I don't have to do that anymore. It's just amazing. I went back home to Brainerd here a month ago and talked with my probation officer, and she couldn't believe that, well, for one, I came in without being hauled in, and for two, that how the change that had occurred, how I had looked, how I carried myself. I used to be really ashamed, and now I'm not ashamed of who I am. So,
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Peroska, your age now is what?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the board. My age is 32.
32, and you went into, you got into drugs at age 15?
Yep. Yes, sir. Thank you.
And Mr. Chair, Mr. Peroska, how long ago did you graduate from Teen Challenge?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm still in Teen Challenge right now. I'll be graduating next month, or actually this month.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, thank you, Mr. Peroska. And we have, this must be Robert McGuire.
Yes, my name is Robert McGuire. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Robert McGuire. I'm 26 years old. I've been using drugs since I was 13. IV use, methamphetamines, heroin since I was 14. Approximately 12 years. I was 140 pounds when I got arrested about 18 months ago. I was in jail for 13 months and they were going to release me on probation, and I decided not to go out on probation. I said, why don't you OR me so I can go to treatment? And I went to Teen Challenge. I've been in Teen Challenge for a little over 3 months now. I'm over 200 pounds now. So, I'm happy, and without Teen Challenge, I'd probably be out there using right now. Teen Challenge is amazing. It's really changed my life.
What does OR mean?
Order of release. They're going to release me on my own recognizance.
Representative Fritz.
Yeah, I have just one question. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And to your testimony and then to the other gentleman who had the five felonies, you said you would, you're happy, and I'm happy that you are, and that you're clean and sober, and that you're not using, but what would else would you be doing if you didn't have cheating challenge? What were the felonies?
Well, I have four felony points, five felony convictions. I probably would be doing 160 months in prison right now had I not went to Teen Challenge.
And what was it? What is robbery?
No. Possession and sales of methamphetamine.
Okay. Thank you. To the other testifier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the board. I was looking at 24 months. I would be, in fact, my probation officer was, her initial thing was to send me to prison for my 24 months. She just said there were, she saw something in me. And I also wanted to say that, you know, I've been to five other treatments before. I've been in and out of treatment, and it just ain't long enough. I mean, when I would leave the treatment, I would still have a desire to go and use it. Just wasn't long enough. And that's Teen Challenges. That's where they are longer and help.
Thank you.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Chair Huntley. Mr. Kraska, what would you point to as the success behind Teen Challenge? I know it's a longer stay, but what do you think it is that makes you turn your life around?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the board. The stay is what makes, what I mean, like I was saying before, the detoxifying, I mean, when I left these other places, I didn't even have a chance to detoxify. And being that it's a faith-based thing, that's one of the things that has really made me turn my life around.
So, Mr. Chair?
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Chair Huntley. So, the change from within?
Yes.
Could you point to that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the board. Yes, absolutely. Thank
you. Representative Gottwald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wonder if any of the testifiers could speak a bit. I think it's germane to what we're discussing around this bill and the others. The impact of methamphetamine, particularly in that area of the state, I think the scope of the problem is another factor in the need that you're describing. Can anybody speak to that?
Mr. Evans.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. With the board, the committee, the impact that it has, that the Rolling Stone magazine called Brainerd the re-rock capital of the world. I mean, that there is actually a higher quality of methamphetamine up there. There's it, everywhere. It's easier for someone to go and get meth than it is for you to get pot, for you to get alcohol if you're underage, or even cigarettes. It's actually easier for a high school student to go and get methamphetamine than it is for them to get cigarettes. I mean, everyone, it's everywhere. It's, you know, and now almost everybody knows how to cook it. And there's even now methods where they're extracting it, methamphetamine, out of urine. I mean, they're doing the same thing. They're using their own body fluids to manufacture methamphetamine.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Gottwell.
Any idea of raw numbers, I mean, in that area of the state, percentage of young people who are...
I can tell you what I saw. Being an inmate at the jail, I'd say at least 80% of the people that came through the jail while I was there were there for manufacturing methamphetamines. Or a first degree methamphetamine case, you know. And I'm not saying that that's an exact number. That's what I was there and saw.
Representative Ward.
Mr. Chair, members, as far as Representative Ward, as far as your question, The number of labs in the Central Lakes area has decreased significantly. The usage, as Seth has suggested, has not. And we still have a major meth problem that we need to deal with, and that's part of this whole plea to help us with that in that area. So I don't have hard and fast numbers, but I can tell you, just as Seth can tell you, and the rest of the testifiers can tell you, that we have a major meth problem there. Thank you.
Representative Abler.
Thanks. And just I want to thank the folks from coming to testify today. It's I think over the course of the years of Seth and heard testimonies like this from Teen Challenge, I think we're continually impressed with the quality of the programming and the results. Just Mr. Chair, to the bill. It's too bad on a fiscal note that it can't reflect what otherwise would have been expended on the same population, because I have to think if they're all in prison, that is a significant price that would be reflected. And I don't think fiscal notes get to reflect that, but I hope as the budget process unfolds that there'll be some money to do this.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to all of the testifiers. First of all, I want to really commend you for coming and telling your stories here. I know it's not a very easy thing to do, to be in this kind of a public arena, and I think I would speak for all of us when I say that we really appreciate your willingness to do that. I'm not really familiar with Teen Challenge before this, but one thing I have gathered from this testimony is that it doesn't really have a lot to do with teens, which is something I would have thought. But the other thing I really wanted to ask about was the faith-based nature of it, and I just wanted to get a little more information about that, whether a person who's going to enter Teen Challenge has to be of a certain faith, whether, you know, how does all that work? Because we are talking here about public funding. Mm-hmm. So could you address that, please?
The Teen Challenge is, the model that we have set up is a Christian model. As a matter of fact, when we licensed our program, we met with the Department of Human Services. They explained to them that this is a Christian model, and they said, we have all sorts of models for drug rehabilitation. There's Native American models. There's acupuncture. There's New Age. And we covet faith-based models. The GRH pays for a board and lodge only. We are not buying Christian services with government dollars. That's been separated out. So we're not asking the legislature to pay for purchasing of Bibles or Christian counseling. This is a mere board and lodge that we get. That's why the supplemental services, on $700, you can't even have 24-hour days a stamp. Even if we just got food stamps, we can get, without the GRH, which we don't get food stamps if you get GRH, but if we get $350 that they would get every month. Just with $700, you can't, or waiting with the supplemental rate, can hardly pay for the room and board and the services. Right? I mean, not services, but the...
Members, we have four more scheduled for questions, and we still have to get to...
Can I just say one more thing, Mr. Chair? I'm sorry. It is open to all faiths. It isn't a requirement that we have people from all faiths that come in to Teen Challenge.
Or no faith.
Yes, or no faith, yes. Yeah. We don't restrict them, and it's not a requirement that they be a Christian. It is the programming is Christian but in nature, but...
Thank you.
Representative Ruth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I too would like to thank the testifiers. I just have a question about Teen Challenge in general. Do you serve people just from Minnesota? Do you take out of state referrals?
The requirement for group residential housing is that you must be a Minnesota resident.
Representative Tao.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's more of a comment. I carried the bill 2 years ago for the Minneapolis facility, and you know, we usually don't share faith here, but I don't share the faith with the pastor there. I chose to carry it because I've seen that it works. I encourage the committee members to go visit the facility, and I encourage the committee to give them full consideration as well. I think it's okay to walk in an attic and come out a Christian, so.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Schubert, I wondered if you had any long-term data on the recidivism rate over a period of time.
We are
as compared to other programs, even.
Mr. Schubert. Yes, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, we're presently doing our own outcome study with Wilder, but there's I'm aware of at least five private university studies or government studies back in the late 80s or early 80s. Department of Health Education and Welfare did a study. I have data on that if anybody wants to see it. And that study showed over 86% of people completed teen challenge. That didn't include Minnesota, were drug-free 7 years after completion of the program. Northwestern University did a doctoral, someone did a doctoral dissertation, and the university endorsed that thesis, excuse me, and that was done 2 years ago. That showed 86%. I know we do not have 86% in Minnesota. Our outcome study done by Wilder, which is some of the best research you can find out there, will give us the numbers. And we're hopefully in 6 months or so to have that data. So we're curious as to what our outcomes are. But I'm pretty confident that they're going to come in over among 60+%. We have a level of addiction today with methamphetamines that's more addictive than heroin that it is harder to kick. And
Mr. Chair,
Representative,
I just want to say thank you also for making this presentation. It certainly is cheaper in the long run than prison, and obviously more effective. Mm-hmm.
Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Pastor Rick, for coming and bringing your testifiers. And I hope that you guys stay on the right path of sobriety. A couple of different things. I actually have teen challenge in my district, and so I hope you do take up Representative Sitow's suggestion about coming to visit. It's a wonderful program. But for members of the committee, and while we all have more treatment bills, keeping in mind that as successful as Teen Challenge has been, it's not a program for everyone. We need multiple models out there. And as the individuals have stated before, treatment the first time, especially if you're only in there for 21 days, you're going to have a less of a successful rate of staying long-term in sobriety. And so we really, although it's costly, and Teen Challenge has other outsourced resources that they're able to pull in to make sure that they're able to get that year, it's one of the things I think this committee needs to look at and struggle with around funding, at least getting us up to 90 days with some of the other facilities and making sure that the equal rates of Teen Challenge and some of the other group home rates are equitable. These are individuals that, as Representative Peterson said, it is more costly to us to have them locked up. Many of the individuals that are in our correction systems have had some form of addiction. Treatment in the correctional facility have limited beds, and we're letting individuals out every single day without having a necessary treatment to be able to be sober, and then they're coming back right back in our communities, not just getting back on their drug of choice, but unfortunately having to come up with a crime to supply their drug of choice. And I also just, in closing, Pastor Rick, I'm thankful that you stepped up to take this challenge on up in Brainerd and Representative Ward taking this, because I'm hoping that you open up some more of my beds for crack. Because as meth has been a challenge for you guys, crack is still a challenge and is the number one challenge for my community and my district.
Yeah. Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just wanted to thank the author for this bill. I think, Representative Ward, you're doing Central Minnesota, which I'm originally from Central Minnesota, close to your district. I think you're doing a huge favor, and you're representing your district well. And I just wanted to thank the testifiers. And this has been said before, but a number of us have already taken the tour, and I personally met with several people who've been through the program, and it's just an amazing, life-changing experience. So I hope you would consider either having a tour again this year, because it was just a great experience for me to meet some of the people and to feel like we can actually support a program bipartisanly that really makes a difference. And I just hope everyone will support this bill.
Okay, with that, I'll lay the lay it over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill, and as it was amended, actually. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for coming. And next we'll go to Assistant Commissioner Koistra.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we had left off on the governmental health initiative that begins on page 183 of the budget book. We were really, we would begin on the top of page 186. Just to remind members that we had mentioned that this is a comprehensive mental health proposal that was really the result of a broad group of stakeholders that worked as the Minnesota Mental Health Action Group. And the governor's proposal is designed to honor the work of that group, and it certainly was not a proposal that was developed in the isolation of our agency. We've already covered developing a model benefit set for mental health across all public programs. This essentially brings the MA services that are currently available through the fee-for-service program to General Systems Medical Care and Minnesota Care. We've already covered the piece of adding an intensive outpatient benefit that would prevent, that would assist clinicians so they do not have to bill for dialectic behavioral therapy and for borderline personality disorder across a number of different categories. And we've already spoken to the development of integrated care networks, because part of the premise of this proposal is an understanding that we need to bring mental health treatment closer to physical health care. We talked about the statistic that people with serious mental illness have lifespans that are 25 years less than the general population, and we need to bring mental health treatment close to physical health care and certainly keep close connections with social services as we're doing that. So on the top of page 186, I want to speak to the next piece of this, which is to address workforce shortages and infrastructure stability through rate increases. I will say as a premise that typically we do not hear a lot from consumers and consumer representative organizations that we need to increase rates, but in this case we are hearing that from everyone, that part of the access issues, and I believe Representative Abler addressed this in the earlier hearing, much of our access issue is related to rates. As background, in last year's bill we requested rate increases. This is one of the few pieces of last year's bill that was authorized by the legislature, and in that bill we increased rates for psychiatrists and advanced practice registered nurses with psychiatric specialty by about 24%. We also increased rates for critical access providers and essential community providers, which are designated by the Department of Health. In this proposal, we're expanding the rate increase. After last year, we heard from a number of providers that we did not cast a broad enough net, and in this proposal, we're going to propose to increase rates for other children's therapeutic services support providers that are other than those that are captured in the essential community provider listing and the community mental health centers. We're also going to be proposing increased rates for medication education services provided by to the ARMS providers and mental health behavioral aid services. These are all areas of service delivery where we understand that rates are a detriment to access to services. The next section is about continuing funding for assistance in collecting and evaluating mental health outcomes. Again, in last year's bill, we requested funds to develop a web-based outcome measurement system for the delivery of mental health services. We received 2 years of funding for that. This is money to continue the maintenance of that program beyond the initial 2 years of funding. So far, we have an outcome measurement being piloted in over 30 counties for children, and we anticipate beginning the adult outcome measurement system in the next 2 to 3 months. So this is continuation funding of what was supported by the legislature last year. The next item is to monitor and track the availability of mental health services. It's been well publicized and well documented that we have issues in access to psychiatric beds. These are issues that are being confronted not only by the hospitals in the psychiatric bed area, but also in the emergency departments and for those delivering crisis services. What we proposed last year and received temporary funding for was the development of a tracking system that will again begin in April to first track the availability of psychiatric beds across the state. This money again is requesting continuation of that. This will allow emergency room departments and as well as crisis providers more ready access to where bed capacity is available. We intend to expand this tracking to other community-based services such as crisis services and tracking the availability of assertive community treatment teams and intensive residential treatment, which is, I mentioned before, with subacute care and so forth. We're going to begin with psychiatric hospital beds and then expand the tracking to the availability and capacity of community-based services.
Members should understand this is a huge issue, usually Minnesota's a leader in things, but we have a huge problem in access to mental health beds. And I actually asked one of my two hospitals, and about 5% of the mental health admits to the St. Mary's Hospital in Duluth are people referred up from the Twin Cities because they can't get in down there.
The next section of the proposal is to improve county financial incentives for ensuring community-based service access for the uninsured. The county and the state uniquely serve as a safety net provider for people with mental illness who are underinsured or uninsured. The safety net includes costly inpatient care at regional treatment centers. The current county share for the regional treatment center cost is 20% from day one of treatment. The current Anoka Regional Treatment Center has an admission waiting list of 40 individuals currently, and usually hovers around 40. But we also have a discharge waiting list of 70 individuals. So essentially at Anoka, if we were able to have timely discharge of individuals from that regional treatment center, we would be able to solve the existing waiting list and more. The average length of stay at Anoka is 90 days. This is the average. It's not the end. It's the average. We know that stabilization for people who need acute care psychiatric admissions is usually within 30 days, and almost in all cases, some exceptions, within 60 days. So what this proposal does is to create an incentive for counties to discharge people on a timely basis by increasing county shares to 50%. After 60 days. In last year's proposal, we retained the county share of 20% through the first 60 days. In this year's proposal, we've eliminated the county share for the first 30 days altogether. Recognize that there's certainly a need for psychiatric hospital care in regional treatment center settings for individuals, and so we're removing county share the first 30 days, but maintaining, as we did in last year's proposal, an increase to 50%. In after 60 days.
Representative Abler.
Thanks. And back to that point, I appreciate the effort recognizing that gap. But do you think that if you tell the charge of counties more, that they're going to put people into places that they can't find to put them into? Is there some leadership in how to find more places to put them? Because I think that's the bottleneck. I think they'd love to stick them somewhere. Is that coming up later, or is that part of this paragraph?
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, in fact, the most of the remaining proposal is about investments into community-based services that we think will prevent hospitalization, and we think will enable counties to better discharge on a more timely basis. We know that they need more resources to do this.
Representative Loeffler.
Mr. Chairman, and this is the question. My point was somewhat similar to Representative Abler's in that if you look at this, there's a penalty of $2.3 million in fiscal year 08 and $4.6 million in 09 for through 2011 in counties that I think have stepped up with property tax dollars when the state was inadequately supporting a service system. And as you know, most of the regional treatment centers mm-hmm.
And most of the bed capacity was in greater Minnesota, and Anoka was never right-sized. Some hospitals, like Hennepin County Medical Center and Regents, stepped up to fill capacity needs, and it seems like I support the idea of accountability and support systems, but to penalize people before the housing opportunities are developed, before the support for the kind of ongoing maintenance that you need to keep people stabilized, which sometimes is just dealing, waking them up every morning and reminding them that this is a work day and they need to move on and stabilize, to intervene with landlords who are about ready to kick them out because of behavior issues that make other tenants in the building nervous. I'm not sure that the model that we're trying to go towards, which has tremendous goals, and I commend all the people from all stakeholder groups that have been working to try and figure out how to build a comprehensive integrated service system, I'm not sure we're there, and I think it's unfair to put huge financial penalties on one component of the system and give the responsibility and money to other components of the system, and I'm looking forward to seeing the legislation as it evolves to see how it best balances the alignment of the timing of resources for all stakeholders as well as the accountability for all stakeholders. I do think this is one that I want to alert us to watch to, because our counties are going to have a hard time dealing with this, and to assume that the capacity will be there to move people out more quickly, I think, is a question that we need to all confront and ask.
Mr. Chair, if I could just respond briefly to that. Representative Lawford raises some, I think, good points. I do want to mention to the committee that this is not, the counties have a maintenance of effort that was instituted last year for mental health. This does not increase their maintenance of effort. This is not intended to be a penalty. It is intended to line up incentives for how we deliver care. Certainly, I think counties can reasonably argue that they try to get people out as quickly as they can. But if we have a situation where regional treatment center placement is cheaper than community placement to counties, that's bad financial incentives. And that's what we're trying to correct here without making any judgments on the behavior of counties. So this doesn't require the revenues shown as a result of the increase do not require counties to expend more than their current maintenance of effort. I would also mention that prior to the maintenance of effort, the amount of county investment in mental health, I believe, and I will check to make sure I'm accurate on this, has been going down statewide. It's certainly different from county to county. But we were starting to lose mental health investments because of other cost pressures that were understandably put on local governments. So I just wanted to kind of throw out a broader set of facts with respect to this. I hope that the revenue projections in this piece of the proposal are wrong, because if things work out right and the investments that we put into the community to support unnecessary admissions and more timely discharges, we won't be gaining the revenues that show up. These revenues are based upon current behavior and current admission and stay patterns. The next section, Mr. Chair, is where we start talking about a number of investments in the community-based infrastructure. This, again, is recognizing both the unique role of both the county and the state in providing a safety net for the uninsured and underinsured. Unlike other healthcare conditions where the safety net is typically emergency rooms and hospitals as uncompensated care, it is typically the county and the state that provides the cost and the service for the safety net for people with mental illness who are not served on a timely basis. The first area of investment would be to develop a statewide mental health crisis intervention and stabilization infrastructure. This will also be aided, by the way, by the addition of crisis services and the model benefit set that we've already spoken to. This funding will add critical crisis resources for both children and adults who are currently uninsured and underinsured. We know now that in our existing crisis services, about 30% of the crisis services are uncompensated. So we have to not just expand benefit sets, but we have to develop a mechanism for supporting the viability of these services, because we know that 30% of their clients are uninsured, and we know that crisis providers cannot refuse services to those with no coverage. So this, our goal in this area of investment is to develop a statewide infrastructure for crisis service for both children and adults, and we certainly think that that will help on the hospital admission crisis issue as well. The next area of investment is to shore up children's school and community-based mental health services. I believe I mentioned earlier in the testimony the other day that we've lost significant federal funds for both children's mental health collaboratives and family service collaboratives in the tune of about $40 million a year of federal revenues by virtue of their of change in federal administrative policy. A lot of those, that $40 million was going towards the delivery of mental health services for children that support children in school-based settings and other settings. What this piece of the proposal does is targets about a third of what was lost towards the most critical clinical services and the most clinical prevention and outreach services that we were losing as a result of those lost funds. We've been able to bridge to some extent the loss of that fund, of those funds, by the use of federal block grant monies, the timing of the, that, how that money is available to me, but we cannot sustain that over the long term. We need this to sustain many of the most critical lost services over the long term. The next area is to develop and support evidence-based practices and best practices. There is a lot of work going on in this state about applying the disciplines of science and research to mental health treatment. And we know that there are certain models that have proven to be more effective than others. We've already mentioned the assertive community treatment teams, and this area will probably be the primary target of investment for these funds. But we also want to continue to support dual diagnosis treatment across the state for people that have co-occurring disorders of both mental illness and chemical dependency. I believe 60% of individuals with serious and persistent mental illness also have a co-occurring chemical dependency. So we have some, I mentioned earlier, a federal grant that we recently received, but that's a very targeted grant. This will help augment the work of that grant, not only in settings that the federal grant does not apply to, but also for children, which the federal grant does not apply to. So this will help us forward that. I also mentioned the Hawaii database, where we have developed a database that will be available to clinicians that will give them information about what treatment works best based upon certain client characteristics. This will help us to provide more training and support for the use of that database. It will also help us further work in co-location models where we bring primary care together with mental health professionals. We've been doing some project work with CentraCare in the St. Cloud area and I believe Children's Hospital more locally, and there's a lot of interest in developing co-location models, but the transition costs money. Also related to that is medical home models, where certainly looking at medical home in a primary care setting, but for people with mental illness, we also want to consider medical home in a mental health clinic setting as well, but under the same sorts of principles. The next area of investment is to develop and support treatment resources for groups of specialized treatment needs. This is to address the growing need for culturally competent services. We certainly have a growing immigrant population. The services we have today do not address the needs of African American population, Latino population, and other multicultural groups where service needs and service approaches have to be designed specifically to address their response to treatment. We also want to use grants to develop more niche services such as eating disorder and treatment-resistant psychosis, where we often have to require individuals to receive services out of state because we have not developed the services within our own state.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Clayster, how far along are we in developing these specialty programs, putting money aside for grants? We talk about it, but I'm just wondering, can you give us a report on how far, where we are in actually implementing and getting up and going?
Mr. Chair, I'm going to ask Sharon and Audie to come and she can give you some more information about the work. I will say, as she's coming up here, that we do have some culprit-specific services that have been developed, certainly having access to the kind of mental health professionals that they need to have access to has been a challenge, and I'll let Ms. Audio give you more information about that.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and Representative Anderson, my name is Sharon Audio. I'm the Director of Adult Mental Health Services, Department of Human Services. In answer to your question, Representative Anderson, over the past now 4 years, we have used a small amount of our federal block grant funds to support most particularly services in two immigrant communities. One is the Southeast Asian community, and then the second is the Somali community. What we've learned from those is a great deal of, I think, interesting data that we would use to expand, because clearly those are only two of very large numbers of communities in Minnesota. That the way that the majority community approaches mental health is very different than it is in the minority community, and we really have to learn from them about what works. What we're finding is that assessment tools need to be different. How people approach mental health issues needs to be very different. In both of those projects, we also have staff who are of that culture, and I think that makes a significant amount of difference in terms of access to services. But we recognize that there's a huge need in the Latino community, and we've really not been able to do much in that community, as well as in the African American community and the other African immigrant communities in Minnesota.
Mr. Chair.
I represent Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mrs. Audio. Do you have a report on what you've done so far, like in the Hmong community, or some statistics of what's happening and how far along you've been that we could have access to?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, yes, we do, and we can get that information through the committee.
Thank you.
Representative Abler, and then we're going to have to
I know we're out of time.
Quit here.
For homework for the department, could you please break down these special incentives you'll be recapturing, so by counties we can know how much each will be incentive to change.
Mr. Chair, well, I don't know if we have a breakdown by county. If you do, we'll get it to you.
Whatever you've got. Thanks.
Sure. Mr. Chair, we have one more investment item on this page, and then I'll cover the page, if that's okay. The final investment item is to expand access to a range of housing options. This, again, is one of the detriments, one of the issues that deters timely discharge, and sometimes even promotes unnecessary admission. And so there's funding in this proposal to develop housing options for individuals with mental illness who need stable housing. We're not being very specific about which options develop, because the housing needs vary so greatly from county to county and city to city. So we want to leave some flexibility in this area. So that's a list of the investments that I'd referenced earlier to Representative Abler's question about what we do to support more timely discharge.
Thank you, Commissioner Toyster. We're going to have to finish, but I want to remind members that tomorrow, for the first 20 minutes, we're going to hear from Doug Wood, who is a cardiologist at the Mayo Clinic and is an expert on reimbursement systems, particularly Medicare. He works with the groups in Washington to set those, and he's going to try to explain to us how physicians get reimbursed for what they do. And then after that, for about 30 minutes, we're going to hear from St. Mary's Duluth Clinic about a really good pilot project that they did that greatly improved the health of people with heart failure, reduced the spending on them dramatically, but because of the reimbursement system, they lost money doing that. And so it should be, at least the first part of tomorrow's meeting, to be very educational. Meeting adjourned.